Hey, Doc Danny here. I just want to say thank you so much for listening to the PT Entrepreneur Podcast. I know there's plenty of other things that you could be consuming or listening to right now. So I want to say thank you for listening to this podcast. And if you listen on a regular basis, I really appreciate that as well. Look, the times have changed a little bit. Everyone is trying to scramble to figure out how they can move their clinical skill set online. And this is something that we've done for years. And we've been sharing this with countless practitioners by jumping on calls with them and trying to help them strategize on what they can do and how they can transition their clinical skill set online, which is very, very possible. So if you are in that boat where you're not seeing people in person the way that you were before or not at all, and you're trying to figure out how to utilize digital visits, programming remotely, and figure all that out, let's jump on a call. 45-minute call. It's totally free. Head to physicaltherapybiz.com/call, and we can help game plan how you can move your clinic online as well. So here's the question. How do physical therapists like us, who don't want to see 30 patients a day, who don't want to work home health, and have real student loans, create a career and life for ourselves that we've always dreamed about? This is the question, and this podcast is the answer. My name's Danny Matei, and welcome to the PT Entrepreneur Podcast. What's up, guys? Doc Danny here, back on the PT Entrepreneur Podcast with my buddy Doug Kachigian. This time is not to, you know, just slay everybody in the PT community with Kelly Starrett on, arguing with each other like dumbasses on Twitter, but to actually talk about his story, his background, what he's doing in business right now. And he's got a pretty cool story. So this is an interview I've been interested in having, for a long time, but we've been so busy that it's been really hard to line some of these things up until now we're in a global pandemic and we have a little more free time. And Doug, he's in New York City. Resilient Performance Systems is the overarching brand. Resilient Performance Physical Therapy is their brick and mortar there in New York City. But he's hunkered down in, where are you again? You're in...
I'm in Massachusetts now.
Massachusetts. So you got the hell out of there.
Yep.
And you ride it out. How were things before you left? Was it getting a little bit wild?
It was about to. You can kind of see the writing on the wall, and there was some rumblings and rumors that the mayor was going to do the whatever it is, hold in place. And it, you weren't sure if it was going to be like a legally mandated thing or it was more recommended. But, I thought there might have been a potential safety risk with the virus. And then just depending on if people were all bottled up, their behavior. And then on top of that, I didn't know that if it was going to be too, we weren't required to shut down, but I don't know how responsible it was going to be to remain open. So we just wanted to make sure we could get our patients squared away with their continuity of care. And then once we did that, we kind of made the decision to voluntarily shut down while we gathered more information. And then it was clear that people weren't willing to leave their apartments, even if we wanted to remain open.
Yeah.
So that's kind of when I, with my wife, went to Massachusetts for a little bit. Now we're just, it's very dynamic, obviously. So I don't think it's going to be normal for a long time. And my guess is that we're going to reopen before it's quote unquote normal. But it's really hard to determine when that point's going to be that we can be responsible on a social level, but while also wanting to deliver care to our patients. So it's kind of a week by week thing.
I hear you, man. I mean, in some ways, I talked to my brother about this and he's like, no, it's, if there's an acute back injury that you can handle versus showing up at the emergency room, you're basically freeing up bandwidth for something that shouldn't really be there in the first place, so some of that is just are you going to capture those people anyway? How could you do that? How can you do the most responsible way? And I think there's so many layers to that about what's the right decision. I think it just depends on the person and their context. I can tell you, if I was in the middle of New York City, I sure wouldn't be there either. I think it's probably not the right place to be with your family. And if you have an option to go somewhere else, there's just a lot of population density. And I kind of geek out on history, and I've been listening to all these podcasts on the Roman Empire and plagues that happened during that time, and especially towards the end of sort of their so-called empire. It didn't crumble in a day, but there were all these processes that happened and things that happened at the same time. It was bifurcation of their government system and strong military leaders that were starting to take people from the overarching kind of group to following them individually, and then they had groups raid them. Then they had a pandemic that wiped out a huge amount of the population. And I'm listening to these and I'm like, holy shit. There's definitely, things that are way worse. 25% of our population is not going to die like it did, in some of these plagues that they had during that time. But population density is where it was the worst, right? So like, it's the way it's going to be, these hotbeds for you, you know, it's interesting. Like we can, I really want to get into your background, cause I think you have a really diverse background and, you know, I'm sure there's things that you've learned, you know, with your time in the military that have helped you in business and getting through school, even now, like, you know, having sort of cool headedness plan of what to do, you know, and kind of not freaking out, which I think a lot of people are. So let's do this, man. Bring me back to A, why'd you go in the Air Force? What made you decide you want to go the route of like kind of going the PJ route? And then, you know, from there, how'd you end up going back to PT school?
Yeah. So I joined the Air Force specifically to be a pararescue man or a PJ. So for people who don't know, pararescue is one of the special operations branches in the US military. But the emphasis is more on medical care and personnel recovery. So personnel recovery just means basically wherever a person in the military or a Department of Defense asset can get in trouble, there needs to be a group that's devoted to retrieving those people and then medically stabilizing them. So typical scenario might be kind of like a downed aircraft. That's one of like the bread and butter missions of pararescue. And then we would also get branched out to various special operations units like Ranger teams or SEAL teams and kind of act as the subject matter expert in medicine and technical rescue. Mm. So technical rescue would involve like, you know, if there was like an IED or like if a vehicle became disabled, we carried specialized equipment to get into those vehicles, because a lot of times in those situations, it's not just about medical care, but you have to actually be able to access those patients. And if you don't have a technical rescue capability, it doesn't matter how much medical training you have. So, it was cool because it provided, you know, us with a really diverse skill set, everything from like scuba diving, parachuting, mountaineering, emergency medicine, all the various like small unit tactics and combat shooting. So it was a really cool experience, and it taught me a lot about how to learn, because the military is pretty good about taking people who are untrained, right? Because if you're a civilian, like, what are the chances that you can do all those things prior to joining? And they've got a pretty finite amount of time to teach those things in large groups. So coming, you know, I went into the Air Force right after undergrad. And like I said, I joined the Air Force just for pararescue. So I'd always been intrigued by some of the special operations jobs in the military, because I like the idea of kind of the physical and the psychological challenge. But even though I'm not a pacifist by any means, the missions didn't necessarily resonate as much as the medical aspect of pararescue. Yeah. And before I even found out about pararescue, I was pre-med in college and went as far as like taking the MCATs and interviewing at schools. And then when I found out about pararescue, it was kind of one of those things where I was like, you know, if I don't do this now, I think I'm going to be the age that I am now, almost 40 years old, and regret that I didn't do it. And that's when I just never wanted to live with regret. So I kind of went in a totally different direction and enlisted in the Air Force. But, you know, it was an amazing experience, made lifelong friends and learned a ton about myself just because it was challenging and it forced me to step outside my comfort zone. And then, so segueing into PT, I did about like 7 to 8 years full time in the Air Force. And then I switched over to part time in the Air National Guard. And so even though that I was in the Guard, it was still a pretty big commitment. Like I still deployed and did a couple of months of training every year to maintain my proficiencies, but I was able to go to grad school for PT and kind of made the decision to do that because, backtracking into college, when I was applying to medical school, I thought I wanted to do primary care sports medicine. I knew I didn't want to do surgery. But then having gone through a lot of medical training in the Air Force, and we did like rotations in hospitals, and just through my own background of like playing sports and training myself, I kind of realized that PT was a better fit. I like the idea, you know, and this is something that obviously you do really well, of kind of combining performance training with rehabilitation. And the more I was exposed to the primary care side of things in sports medicine, the more you realize that they're kind of more of a triage platform. Like they're either sending people to ortho or to PT or doing more of the imaging and like the injections, which people need that. I'm not saying, you know, that's, I refer out to those providers all the time, but I just like the idea of having more of that continuity of care from like the acute care side of things into the return to sport and the performance aspect. So I was kind of lucky that I joined the Air Force, because when you're like 21 years old, it's really hard to make a decision about what you want to do the rest of your life. And then once you're in medical school, right, like you're pretty invested, it's kind of hard to say, I want to do something else after that. So, you know, just being exposed to all those different things gave me a different perspective that I think allowed me to make a better decision for myself. And then, so funny enough, I finished my, my DPT program in 2014, and I couldn't even start working as a PT until about 8 months later, because I was still in the guard and I was on the hook for a deployment. So as soon as I graduated PT school, I went into our like 3 or 4 month pre-deployment spin up, deployed to Africa for a few months. And then from there, you know, started my practice. And that was one of those things where, you know, having that Air Force experience allowed me to save a bunch of money. I didn't join the Air Force for education benefits, but I was fortunate enough to have the GI Bill pay for PT school. So unlike a lot of people, I didn't graduate, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars in debt, which I think allowed me to take a little bit more risk when I graduated. I just knew from, luckily my school program was really good about letting us set up our own clinical program or our own clinicals.
Cool.
So I went with people that like were doing the kind of things that I wanted to do and worked in that kind of a setting. But I knew enough from other people's experiences that, you know, I didn't want to work in a mill in kind of a more volume-based practice. Like honestly, and I'm not saying this to be critical, because I understand that there's a need for that and some people just have no other choice but to go through an in-network plan. But I think I rather would have probably stayed in the military than done that. I just think that the profession has so much potential, and working in that setting would have taken the joy out of it for me.
Yeah.
And luckily, like I said, I wasn't in debt where I could make a decision that I was going to be happy with, and not, I didn't have that financial pressure to do something else. So, I started my own thing, had no idea what I was doing, but I was lucky enough that, you know, I had a safety net where I could make some mistakes and still kind of survive through it at the end. And then, you know, I'm sure you'll get into where I'm at now, but, it's one of those things where, you know, I knew that there was kind of a different setting that I wanted to work in, and I wanted to be able to control the environment. And coming from the military, where even though it was a special operations unit where it was kind of very decentralized and informal compared to the rest of the military, it was still formal enough that I was like, I just want to be able to work for myself, not have to answer to like 10 different people and
totally.
Bureaucracy, chain of command. It's like, you know, the nice thing and the hard thing about having your own practice is that you have total control and freedom, but that's also the hard part too, is that,
yeah.
You know, it's a lot more pressure. But the cool thing is like, if something goes wrong, it's mainly your fault,
yeah.
Which is a lot of responsibility, but it's also, I wouldn't trade that freedom for anything at this point.
Well, you know, it's funny. I totally agree with you on that in terms of the challenge with your own business is that, yeah, you have complete control over what you do, positively and negatively, right? Like if you want to work 16 hours a day, you can do that. No one's going to make you. No, and if you want to play Mario Kart all day, you can do that too. No one's going to make you stop doing that. But, you know, what I think is interesting is, you know, having seen that, I think what we can do is take elements, at least for me, take elements of the structure that's inherently necessary in the military to make a bunch of people that, like you said, that are young and have minimal experience function together to achieve a mission, which is a hard thing to do. So I get why they have so much kind of so much redundancy, because as you see some, you're like, there's no way somebody did this. Because if there's a sign that's telling you to do something that's obviously a bad idea, it means somebody did it and they had to put a sign up for it, right? So like, there's exactly. Not that, like there's some people that are not that smart. And so, but for me, I was like, I want nothing to do with this. And what I realized was, as soon as we started to bring other people on, this sort of chaos that I was fine in, other people do not function in that well. And in fact, it's the best way to ruin your business. So, you know, for you, what elements of your training in the military did you take, you know, from that and have been able to apply that to, like you said, your ability to learn, so education in school, with a bunch of other stuff going on, and then start your business. So what did you take with you?
Yeah, obviously a couple of things there. So the, going back to like the training and the education, you know, I think that physical therapy as a profession is, you know, the pendulum swings, right? But I think that it's kind of going in this more like research oriented academic type direction, which is fine, because we don't want to have like this thing where, oh, we always did it this way, so we're going to keep doing it that sure. way. But I think it's become academic to the point that people have become a little bit paralyzed to just like make a decision and do something. And, you know, you see these circular debates that go on and on. It's like, at the end of the day, you have to make a decision and do something with somebody. You can get into the semantics of things, but what the military does really well is, you know, like with emergency medicine, I'm not saying that like they train us to operate the level of like a PA or a physician in the emergency room, but in a very short amount of time, we were comfortably able to do, you know, minor surgical procedures like cricothyrotomies and chest tubes. We were giving blood transfusions in the field, administering narcotics, you know, advanced airway stuff, things that, you know, in a civilian environment would probably, just because of all the formality and like the academic red tape, would take years to learn. And so the military does a really good job of, yeah, you need to have some theoretical background to appreciate and understand what you're doing, but they don't overwhelm you with that, because I think that a lot of times, like in some of these formal academic programs, the way that people are weeded out is by like, how much stuff can you memorize and regurgitate for a test? Sure. But I liken it to, if the test that we took in grad school were that important, like I should be able to go back right now and at least pass any test that I took in my DPT program. And I can guarantee you that I'll probably, like, I would fail my anatomy practical if I went back to it, because in real life, do you have to memorize like verbatim the origin and insertion of every muscle and be able to, right. So that stuff is, you know, it's the whole thing where like all models are wrong, but some are useful. I think that, you know, in an academic environment, you're like memorizing these models and taking them literally. And then the next week you learn a different model and you're like, what the hell am I actually supposed to do? So the military does a good job of kind of integrating all those models, but ultimately it's about like practical application, because, you know, in the settings that we worked in, like I might be responsible for treating 3 traumatic, you know, casualties with life-threatening injuries. So there's no room for false confidence. And again, the care that I would administer in that environment, I'm not going to say is comparable to what people get in a civilian environment, because we had less resources. I'm not trained at the level of what a PA or a physician would be, but you kind of have to be comfortable, and you can't delegate responsibility to someone else. Now, you know, I think the military, maybe sometimes because of the pressure to pump people out, maybe did cut some corners. So there's a middle ground between like, yeah, just, you know, overly academic and multiple choice tests, and then, you know, trying to get people through so they can go to Afghanistan or Iraq where they're needed, right? But so there's advantages to both worlds, and I think that having been exposed to both worlds was very helpful. So that was kind of on the training side what was very useful. And then, you know, you mentioned that like the military is really good at developing standard operating procedures and systems. So that's important, right? Because even though, you know, procedures and systems, if you follow them too rigidly, can make you, you know, unadaptable to chaotic situations, you have to have some kind of a template or a structure to at least start from.
Yeah.
Then if you're able to kind of decentralize command within those standard operating procedures, now you've got the kind of the almost like the best of both worlds, as far as like you've got, you know, you can manage chaos, but you also have some structure as well. So there's always this fine line between rigidity and chaos. The more, you know, dogmatic you are about these procedures, the more rigid you are. But if you don't have them, now it's chaotic. You have no structure at all. So what the military is really good at is, in a chaotic situation, you always have your emergency procedures. So like I was on a training parachute jump one time, and you know, my main parachute opened up, but there was, I wasn't able to access one of my steering toggles. One came down and one didn't, which put me in an uncontrollable spin. I couldn't control my canopy, and we were kind of released over a major highway. So it's not a good thing if you can't control your canopy, right? But like, we've rehearsed our emergency procedures literally before every single jump. So it's like, all right, I guess it's really happening now. You know, I'm going to arch, I'm going to grab my red handle, grab my gray handle, pull, you know, now I've got my reserve parachute over my head. So, it, you know, if you get like ambushed, you've got a procedure for that. You've got a procedure for reacting to contact, all these different things. So even though maybe some of these procedures aren't perfect, in a chaotic situation, you know, the 80% solution is better than the perfect solution that's going to happen a day later. So being able to, what it teaches you to do is to control the controllables. Like, even though you're probably in that situation not going to be able to come up with the perfect solution, if you have a solution that's good enough or robust enough, now you can kind of survive. So that's kind of, you know, obviously very helpful in a time like this, because having experienced enough of that stress, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, this is still stressful for me because we're not generating any revenue, but at least we know there's things that we can control and we'll just focus on those. And the rest of it is just making yourself crazy, right? Because you can only do so much.
So, you know, you bring up a good point though. And I've had some conversations with friends of mine just this past week that are, you know, business owners now coming out of the special operations community, and they're just like, they just seem super chill, man. And compared to many of the other friends that I have that are entrepreneurs that are freaking out, and they're just like, oh my God, it's my business is over. This is ending. You know, who knows what's going to happen. And that's, I guess that calmness under pressure, that calmness with the unknown. I feel like, you know, I was I was a physical therapist in the Army. I have by no means gone through anything like you or any of the other people that I'm referencing right now. So I always like to learn from people that are better at plenty of things than I am, you know? And I think you even bringing up, you know, pulling your parachute, your reserve chute, and I've seen you in a wind tunnel too, by the way, and you're pretty damn good there too. Made it all of us look bad. but when you look at your training and what you've learned from that and some of these stressful situations, and I know, you know, Lackland Air Force Base, when I was at Baylor, we had rotations through there, and we would see they're damn near just trying to drown you guys, it seemed like, half the time. When you were going through training, I was like, Jesus, this is intense. I didn't even know what a PJ was. And then I saw that, I was like, this is crazy. So, you know, all the stress, these things that you've gone through, you've tested yourself. People that haven't done that, people that haven't, like, you know, really gotten confidence from being in it and being able to see what they're capable of, what advice do you have for them to handle difficult times, unknown, without, you know, stressing out and really just being able to look at it in a way where they can, you know, improve themselves?
You know, the first thing is, like, I do get stressed out. Like, when this first started, and the hard part about this is, in some ways, I don't want to say that, like, what I did in the military was easier than now, but, like, when your parachute isn't opening, there's really, like, only one thing you can do. You can do that one procedure, and yeah, it's a known thing. Like, okay, your parachute is uncontrollable. You have to do something. With this, it's really hard to strategize, you know, if you're a business owner, because you don't know how long it's going to go on. Like, if somebody said, okay, this is going to be over in 2 weeks and you're going to be able to reopen again as normal, that would you know, demand one strategy. Whereas if I knew, hey, this is going to go on for 6 months, yeah, I would do something totally different. So it's, in the military, you're developing procedures for concrete things. This is not concrete at all. You really, it's hard to develop these procedures because you don't know how long it's going to last. So I did have moments where I was like, this is, you know, what the hell am I going to do? But then you just kind of go back to, what can you actually control? I'm lucky enough that, you know, I've got two business partners, like, we're all equal partners. And to backtrack a little bit, like, how we got together was, I was in the library in PT school one day, and I saw a guy wearing a Mike Boyle strength and conditioning t-shirt.
Nice.
And I'm kind of like, I went up to him, I'm like, what are you doing with this shirt? Like, well, you're in the Columbia Library, you know? And then he told me that he had interned for Boyle. And then I, you know, he told me that he was a year behind me in PT school. He introduced me to Greg, who, prior to PT school, was a strength coach for the Arizona Diamondbacks. So we all kind of hit it off because we had that performance lens through which we looked at things. And so I graduated a year before them. I kind of got started. And then when they graduated, you know, it's too long a story to get into, but basically we always had the idea that we wanted to work together. But we sort of got forced into working together earlier than we wanted to because of the facility that we worked in. And it ended up being fine. But that's part of the answer to your question, is it helps to have people that you can, like, rely on. So luckily for me, I'm not going through this alone. I've got two equal partners, and we're very supportive, and we all have different strengths and weaknesses. And, like, we just happen to complement each other very, very well. So that makes it a lot easier because, you know, when I'm having my moments where I'm like, oh, this is going to be really bad, you know, I'll get a text or a call from one of those guys and, like, hey, you know, I'm working on this, I'm solving this problem. And it's like, oh, that was the problem that I was kind of hung up on, and they solved it. So I would say that, you know, if you are a business owner, some people just, you know, they own the business themselves, but you need to have a team. Because if you don't have a team, like, you can't do everything yourself. You have to be able to delegate and, you know, like, in a situation like this, try to set it up where you can work to your strengths and then find people who have a complementary skill set and put them to work. And then you'll feel a lot better, because if you have to dwell on the things that you're not that good at now, when there's all this doubt lingering, it can be much more, you know, frustrating and daunting. So have a team. And then beyond that, I would say, like, try to make things as structured as you can, because it's very easy now when, like, you know, you're not a slave to your schedule. Like, I don't have a patients from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. at these times.
Yeah.
So, like, try to set an alarm every day and try to have, you know, like, hours allocated during the day where you're working on very concrete objectives that you've written down, like, hey, what can I control now? What can I do about it? And set a schedule. Because otherwise, like, if you don't have that structure and those procedures in place, it's very easy to just go on Twitter and read about how the world's coming to an end. And it's like, it's, you know, I'm not saying this isn't a bad situation, but I don't think it's as bad as what social media and the news portrays it to be. And even if it is, like, how is that helping you to read about how this many more people died than yesterday? Like, unless you're one of those people, you can't really do anything about it. So, like, I've tried to, in the beginning, you know, when I was trying to figure this out, I was falling to that trap of like, well, what do I do now? I'm going to go check my email. And even email, like, email is a huge distraction. Like, I now have like set hours where I don't check my email, because otherwise I won't get anything done. Because as soon as you open one email, it just leads to, it could lead to an hour of BS work that isn't that important to your business.
Yeah.
But you feel obligated to answer somebody. Same thing with a text, right? Like, if you check a text message, you don't just answer somebody and it's over. There's this back and forth, and it can go on for 20 minutes before that text thread has closure. Yeah. So I'm not saying ignore people and shut yourself off from the world, but you have to have hours where you're treating it like, even though it's not your normal day-to-day work of patient care, you've got to have hours where, like, all right, I'm on duty now, and I'm not going to allow for any distractions outside of maybe like a family emergency. So I would say just try to structure it as best you can, and like literally write down like what needs to be done and how are you going to do it? And at the end of the day, like, it's always satisfying to be able to check things off a list.
Yeah.
And you know, like, that satisfaction of like, when you decide, okay, I'm done formally working for the day, checking items off the list is a really, really psychologically, I think, is very, very helpful.
Yeah, I agree. And to your point of, you know, having partners to work with, and, you know, Ashley and I are married, but we're business partners in, you know, in our local practice. And it's so helpful. Like, you know, what she's good at, I'm bad at. And what I'm bad at, she's good at. And we offset each other. And I think it's incredibly beneficial. You know, and even in PT biz with Jared and Eve, like, we're all good at different things. And you know, just having a cadence where we check in with each other, it's so helpful in a time like this, because there is so much unknown. And one thing we've even noticed with people in the mastermind group, there's people that are individual, like, you know, sole practitioners, single business owners. I think for them, you know, just seeing that other people are dealing the same problems. And like, we knew this from a business standpoint, like, it's cool to have some inherently positive competition, but also when times are rough, like, having people that can kind of pick you up and share ideas with you, and you change your mindset, your confidence improves. Like, it's such a powerful thing. And I think for people just in general right now, the ones that are just straight up isolating themselves, and they've lost that sense of sort of community and people around them support, that's where it's going to become so problematic for them, because all they are going to focus on is what they see on TV, the negative, and they get sucked into that, or, you know, they get sucked into things that are not beneficial. But what I look at as of right now, and I know you guys are working on some digital things, is, man, what a golden opportunity, what a gift of time we've been given. Like, there's so many things I'm working on right now. I can barely sleep. I'm so excited to get up and knock these things out, because I haven't had the bandwidth. I didn't think I would have the bandwidth for months. As we brought another person on in our company to hire and take my clinical care hours away. And now all of a sudden we can work on these things, you know? So for you guys, I know, you know, some elements of digital things you've wanted to do for a while. We've talked about this, and now you have this opportunity to do it. So where are you guys trying to go? Like, what sort of online presence are you trying to create within, you know, Resilient Performance Systems? And what are you working on now?
Yeah. So we actually filmed, we used to do, seminars where it wasn't the kind of thing that we were like trying to pitch on people, but we had different gyms and like sports teams reach out to us and say, you know, just because of some of our social media stuff and our blogs, they were like, hey, would you guys ever want to do a seminar? So kind of on a, you know, request basis, we would do some seminars. And then it became the kind of thing where, you know, even myself as kind of a consumer of Con Ed, it's really hard when you're busting your ass all week to like fly to a course, sit for 2 days for a course. And, you know, it's also expensive too, right? Because unless the course is in your local area, you might spend $1,000 between airfare and hotels just getting to the course.
Yeah.
And then you fly back Sunday, and you like, it starts again on Monday, right? You're not going to take a day off to go to a course. So I think the Con Ed space is definitely going more in the online direction. So we had the idea of taking that seminar that we did and just, you know, filming it in a more professional environment, and then releasing it as an online course. So we started that like almost a year and a half ago, and now it's pretty close to being released. But, you know, because of the situation, we've had a lot more time to edit it and put the finishing touches on it. Not to say that online education is a substitute for in-person, because I think that when you go to a course in person, the best part, and same thing with a mastermind group, like as much as you guys put together a great formal curriculum, the best part is at night at the bar talking to everybody. That's an education in itself that you can't replace. And you know, so you don't have that element in an online course, but people just want to consume information. I think that the, you know, online is kind of the way to go. Even for myself, like it's just so much easier to go to a course and go through a course at your own pace. So we want to, I mean, and the idea of kind of decentralizing education, I think things like fellowships and internships are great, but there's also a lot of red tape with fellowships.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, there's not a, always a practical emphasis. I think that even with the fellowships, it's kind of more about like the academic aspect. It's a multiple choice test. And it's the kind of thing where even in PT school, right? Like we had a whole class on gait where we had to be able to regurgitate the joint angles for every phase of the gait cycle. But you could learn all that stuff and be able to regurgitate it, but it doesn't mean that if you work with a runner the next day that you'd be able to actually like work on running mechanics with them. So again, I think that some of the formal programs are a little bit too academically oriented. So we're ultimately hoping to create kind of like an online type experience where it's like, hey, what are the things that a sports oriented physical therapist or kind of a, you know, a more complete strength coach needs to be able to know to work from like that acute rehab stage all the way to return to sport. And I don't know if like, from what I've seen, formal programs aren't doing a great job of that. So I think that, you know, they do a good job of getting somebody from like, you know, kind of the really acute situation to quote unquote, like normal function. But as far as getting, progressing somebody to being able to sprint and change direction and do the things that need to be done in a sporting scenario, I think there's some, you know, much to be desired there. So that's kind of the goal. We want to release the first course, which is a little bit more kind of general, more like strength training oriented, and then develop like a change of direction module and a linear speed module, but more for like the rehab audience, because I think that the strength and conditioning community is doing that really well, but I don't think that the physical therapy world is doing that enough yet. So that's kind of our emphasis now. And this situation has allowed us to work more on those things. And then even through my own experience as a clinician, you know, my practice is out of network or cash based. So I think that the incentives in that scenario are much more conducive to like, you have to respect people's time, and you can't just say, hey, you're going to come in 3 days a week for 8 weeks, especially when people are paying pure cash. It's like, it's market forces, I think, help to incentivize people to do the right things as far as, hey, like get people what they need and then get them out. You can't milk them because there's this insurance gravy train, you know, keeping things going. So, but even in that scenario, I'm like, do people even need to pay our cash rate or our out of network rate? Like, is there something that people could look at even before that would provide value? Because even a lot of what I do, like if I'm being honest, there's only so many ways that you can treat low back pain. We always like to say people are unique and individuals, but a lot of people I work with get the exact same stuff. I can know that when they walk in the door without even evaluating them. So I think that like, ultimately, if we could create a platform that almost acts as like a triage point where we want to keep people out of the medical system, because once they're in, there are a lot of incentives for people to get, you know, more tests, more treatment. And I think the longer people are in the medical system, the worse off they generally are.
Yeah.
So if there's a way to kind of, you know, eliminate the false positives, because even in our setting, you know, cash and at a network, I think there are a lot of people that don't even really need to see us, but there's a lot of incentive for medical providers to monopolize the musculoskeletal pain population, because once it becomes a medical thing, right? Now people who aren't medical providers can't treat them. And I think there obviously are situations where people have legitimate pathology and they shouldn't be seeing, you know, a strength coach or a trainer. But a lot of this is just different, is professions trying to monopolize things and reduce competition. And even though like if other people outside of medical providers could treat things like lower back pain that didn't have ridiculous symptoms or motor weakness, I kind of welcome that competition, because I'm not just like a business owner. Like I am a consumer of healthcare. Like I want myself and my family to have choice, and I want other people to have choices. And I think that having competition makes all of us better. And I think right now the incentives are such that, you know, even though people are saying, oh, we're advocating for the patient, this is a medical problem, a lot of the things that even I see, I don't think are medical problems. And I think that people should have cost-effective solutions outside of seeing a medical provider in person to help themselves, because, you know, even like insurance-based medical care is not free. That money comes from somewhere. And if people knew like the actual cost of that, I think they'd be a lot less apt to just keep getting medical care for things that don't necessarily warrant it. Does that kind of make sense?
Totally. You know, and this is the, this reminds me so much of, you know, talking to Kelly Sturette about Mobility Watt and the origin of that. And a lot of it was things that he wanted people to work on their own, but hopefully that they would work on it before they would come and see him in person, right? So they would come in, they would say, okay, I've already done this and this and this. And he's like, cool, just save yourself two visits. You know, like now we can work on this thing. And you end up, you know, I'll end up seeing you half as many times. And, you know, I think it's the direction that a lot of people would like to have that information. I mean, not everybody, some people are just lazy. They're just like, hey, just stick a needle in something and then let's hope it goes away. But yeah. Plenty of people, you know, especially when we get a chance to work with people in a cash setting, they want to be informed. And I always tell people, I had a conversation yesterday with a guy, or I'm sorry, last week, and he had chronic lower back pain. And I was like, look, man, by the time we're done with you, you're going to be able to honestly help people that have back pain and in a way where you can pay this forward, because you're going to learn so much about what's going on with you and how to manage your own symptoms. Because the likelihood of you had, you know, 20 years of a problem, the likelihood of you having some sort of reaggravation is very high. You know, it's almost inevitable that that's going to happen. But what do you do after that happens? How empowered are you with that? And he's like, I've literally never had somebody ever talk to me about understanding how to treat myself, you know, and it's sad, because I think that that's the direction that, you know, everyone should go. But then you see the dollars and cents of it, and a stem cell injection is $5,000, you know, and you're right. Paying $200 for a packet of cells. Like, yeah, okay. If you're in private practice, like that can sway your decision making a little bit. I do think that for what you guys are doing though, and maybe I'm a biased consumer, because I would totally buy your course. And it's because I know you have some extensive training in, you know, PRI work, and outside of that, like legit strength and conditioning credentials, and the mixture of those things, I think is a really challenging thing to put together. Because, you know, I've been through a handful of PRI courses, and I think some of the things that they talk about, spot on. Like they just absolutely have figured some stuff out. But when they talk about loading people and training people, I almost couldn't disagree more with some of the ways that they talk about doing it. Because I'm like, dude, I don't think you would put this weight on somebody's back and have them squat this way if it had 400 pounds on it. You know, like there's certain elements of like strength and conditioning, I think, that you have to draw from to mix with things like, you know, PRI or Kelly stuff, or, you know, whatever, functional range conditioning and all these other things that are out there. But yeah. How do you mix that with loading somebody appropriately and training in multiple directions? And I think that is where it's very hard. And if you can solve that problem about how to utilize these advanced skills to adjust or manipulate symptoms followed by reintegration of movement patterns, like that's a really, really tough nut to crack.
Well, and that's a great point. I think that's, you know, to be fair to all these courses, I don't think any of these courses are advertising that they are this comprehensive system.
Right.
They have a very specific intent. So, you know, like, and that was kind of, you know, if you take like a business course, it's always like, oh, you've got to have your niche. I think that like our niche is the opposite of a niche. It's kind of like, how do you integrate all these things together? Because my frustration with Con Ed was always like, okay, I would go to a course and I would get a lot out of it for a very specific thing. But how does this fit into a greater treatment plan? And so that's kind of more of our focus, is like, we're not saying that this is like the best mobility course, the best strength course, but it's how do you put all these things together into a comprehensive plan or system, and kind of more of a connecting the dots. I think a lot of the Con Ed focus is like, okay, this is a dot on the map, but they don't tell you how to connect it, how to apply, how to integrate everything else that you're doing. And from a business standpoint, most of these courses, they don't want to acknowledge that there's other things that are good too, because then, you know, they want to make it like, oh, this is the only thing that you should do. And I get that. But going back to the, you know, the all models are wrong, some are useful. Everything that you mentioned, I've taken all those courses and I've gotten a lot out of all of them. But if that's all I did, and that's why, like for me, the best teacher was treating. Like, I know people always want more formal education, but that was another thing in the military that they were very good at, was like the self-awareness of when you go on a mission, the first thing you do after you get your prep your gear for the next mission is you debrief that mission and you go around the room and you say, okay, like what could we have done better? And it's an environment where everybody speaks their mind very freely and you can't BS the person to your right and your left. And when you do that, you realize like, okay, like there's a lot of mistakes that we made or things we could have done better. So we've kind of taken that to our patient care where if you're honest with yourself, you know immediately like what you could have done better or where you got stumped. And my first year after graduating PT school, there were a lot of things I realized that I didn't know. And I went wherever I could to find the answer. So when I was working with a runner, you know, there are people where I was like, I know that no matter what we do on the table or in the weight room, unless you change your running mechanics, you're going to keep having the same injuries.
Yeah.
I didn't think there were a lot of PTs that were doing a great job with things like sprint mechanics. So I reached out to Derek Hansen, who's like great at that. And we set up a private course where I actually had him evaluate a couple of the athletes that I was working with. And we just watched him coach. It wasn't PowerPoint. Yeah. It wasn't like, here's what you should do. It's like, show me what you would do with this person, and learned a ton from that. And then, but being able to take that and actually apply it, because if you don't apply it, you know, there's like, at one point I was like a seminar groupie where I'd go to all these seminars, but I was thirsting for more and more knowledge, but I didn't actually use it. Like you have to be, even if you're not willing to do it with patients, do it in a low threat environment, do it with friends or relatives or people, even like pro bono. Like if you're afraid that you don't have the skill set yet, you don't want to charge for it. People, you could try on people for free as long as you're, you know, safe about it. So I think we're more about like connection, but to your point, all those things that you mentioned before, like they're good, but they're not meant to be comprehensive. So we're not going to go into as much depth about mobility as a mobility specific course, but we're hoping that we can help people kind of see the bigger picture, which I think that from a branding standpoint, people are afraid of, because it's like, oh, well, we have to be niche specific. Like,
yeah.
I don't think that our niche is just like, you need to be a human being and then work backwards from your goals, you know?
Yeah.
And the more you kind of see the patterns in the big picture, the more you realize that like ACL rehab is not really any different than FAI rehab. It might be in the beginning,
right,
but if you're working with a lacrosse player, it doesn't matter what surgery they had at the end, their preparation or their rehab should look the same regardless of their surgery. And so everything now is so protocol and algorithm driven, but eventually all these different things, depending on the goal or the end state, should kind of blend together. So that's kind of what we're hoping to do. We'll see if we do it successfully or not.
Well, I think that, you know, to your point, people coming out of school, I was like this. I felt like school prepared me to pass a test. And then what I was really interested in and sort of what I you know, I had a background in strength and conditioning that I wanted to be able to utilize. And we didn't get into much of that in PT school. And the closest thing was like FMS. And I actually remember, so Johnny Owens, who does all like the BFR stuff, he was actually the director of the Center for the Intrepid, where they have all these amputee rehabs. I did my research there. So Johnny and I mean, I knew him way back in the day, because he was the only person that I ever saw it that I was associated with the school, with our school, that was doing like protocol based progressions and regressions of multi-directional movements. And he had all these like charts built out, and my brain almost exploded when I first met him as he was trying to explain this stuff to me. And that guy is a sharp guy. Obviously he's done really well for himself with all the things he's doing with blood flow restriction training, but it's not by accident. He's incredibly smart. And he had taken some of the functional movement principles and applied that to, you know, actual like traditional strength and conditioning, getting people back to moving fast and heavy loads and all that. And with amputees. And that's where I first saw it. And I was like, man, I don't know what he's doing, but I got to learn more about it. So I went in the rabbit hole of FMS and then SFMA, and I'm going through all these courses, and it's like, now I got introduced to kettlebells, and now I got to learn more about kettlebells. But no one really, you know, I had like a desire to learn. It was like obsession is probably a better way to put it. I was just like, how quickly can I learn more? And I always had this thing in mind where, you know, I was like, hey, in 5 years, I want to know where I'm at in comparison to my peers, because we all started at the same place, and I want to be nowhere near anybody else. And in my head, I always thought that. So I'm like, I had to go to everything I possibly can. But the problem was, just like you're saying, it's content, 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 no context.
Yes,
no context exactly. There. And I would get back, and then for a week, I'd be like, I would do one thing. Everybody would get one thing. You know, everybody would get kettlebell arm bars whenever I went to the SMF2 car. I'm like, kettlebell arm bars are awesome for everybody. I didn't know. So it's like organization of that. And I think that, a course can be great for that. You know, and I think also some of it is just conversations. You know, it's like, hey, in this situation, like you said, these after action reviews, in this situation, you know, what would you do here? Or what did you do with this patient? Explain that. And I think so much value comes from that, you know, and being able to like have those conversations. But I think also for a lot of people, it's uncomfortable, you know, for them to be able to explain where they're deficient and how they could be better. You have to really be aware and self-aware and be okay with that, you know? So, you know, for you guys, do you have elements of that within your own practice? Because the three of you guys are sharp and it seems like, you know, you'd be able to help progress each other by challenging each other as well.
Yeah. I wish we had more of that. We're often practicing in different locations. I mean, I obviously have them
busy.
I have them as a sounding board for anything, but I mean, like, luckily I've got enough people like in my network where if I do get stumped by something, I can, you know, it's kind of a text message away. But to your point about like sharing information, I think that we need to share a lot more case studies. I know there's this whole like evidence hierarchy and now the RCT has become the gold standard for things, but the reality is like we learn through trial and error more so than we do by design. And people love to speak in abstracts like, oh, you should do, you know, graded exposure or progressive overload. But it's like, what does that actually look like in practice? Everyone agrees, yeah, graded exposure is great. But what does that look like for somebody who, you know, plays a field sport? So like we've written a bunch of case studies on our website, not because we think like this is the best way to do something, but it's like, hey, we're just being transparent. And a lot of people I think don't want to do it because when you write down exactly what you did, it makes you vulnerable. Now some troll on the internet can be like, why'd you do that? That sucks. But that's how I learned. I learned because I had mentors who were very, very like transparent and forthcoming with what they actually did. And then, you know, I would try that stuff myself. And then it's kind of like the whole Bruce Lee thing, like use what's useful, disregard what's useless. And that's going to depend on your environment because what works for us might not work for somebody listening that has a different patient population. But we have to start somewhere. That's why I think case studies is the ultimate, like, no BS. Okay, like, what do you actually stand for? Because it's what you did. And then you can kind of deduce, talk about the theory and the rationale after that. But if you look at enough case studies, you see themes emerge or enough programs. So I wish there was a lot more of that. I think that's how we would learn more. But I think that, you know, especially with social media, it's a lot more about proving people wrong and grandstanding than it is about actually disseminating information. And you mentioned even some of the courses you took, like, for example, like I personally don't do the FMS, but I could see the value in taking an FMS course because even if you don't apply the FMS exactly how it was taught in the course, knowledge isn't this like robotic thing where, you know, you have to literally apply everything that you're taught. It's really, really messy. And any educational experience you have could provide insight that sparks something that's totally revolutionary and transformative for you. So there are courses that I took that, like, even now I look back and I'm like, well, I don't really use it that much, but how do I know that I wouldn't have arrived at the next important point if I hadn't even taken a course that maybe showed me what I don't want to do? Yeah. So, you know, a lot of times I hear a lot of these con ed courses, people, they're getting trashed on the internet because like they're not evidence-based or because they find things that are theoretically implausible. But there are things even in courses that I've taken where maybe like the theory that they use to justify the technique isn't very good or evidence-based or robust, but like the techniques themselves are great. So it's like, okay, like I've been to manual therapy courses where I'm like, wow, these techniques are awesome when I use them on people, but the rationale for it was kind of like, oh, I don't think that you're really doing that. But it's like, so what? I'll take the technique and then I'll apply my own, I'll integrate my own framework into that technique.
Yeah. So, well, not only that, but the bottom of the evidence-based hierarchy is expert opinion. So, you know, like this, it pisses me off when, you know, I see this with like, I mean, Kelly and I have a personal relationship and like anytime I see somebody bagging on him, I don't take it very well. And people love to hate on him because he doesn't have a bunch of research articles that he's personally been a part of. Right. But hundreds of thousands of athlete sessions across multiple different groups, that's expert opinion. That's reps. That's pattern recognition. I would take a couple days with somebody like that and learn from them and see, all right, shorten the curve for me. Like show me what, you know, what you're seeing, what you learned, what not to do, because it's test, retest. Oh, this is working. Okay. Do more of this, do less of that versus, and we all know research can be highly biased. Like I've been a part of it. I've sat there while our research director redid some SPSS stats to find a minor statistically significant change just so we could get a publication on something. And I was like, dude, at first we didn't have it and now we do. And it's barely there. And it's just because you tweaked a couple things. So, you know, but no one thinks that is quite as, like the opinion is quite as valuable of somebody that's done it a ton. Like you sit in a room with a coach for 20 years, like Brett Bartholomew is a good friend of mine. And like, if I want to know about speed and agility, if I want to know about change of direction and deceleration, I just ask Brett, like, hey man, what do you like to train? Not give me 20 articles to read and I'll come to my own conclusion. Like, just tell me what the hell I need to do. Show me how to do it correctly. And then boom, I'm going in there and I'm going to start doing it and applying it to what I'm working with. So I think to your point, it's swung very far that direction. And I think it'll come back kind of to the middle and people will realize like, okay, cool. We need a bit of both of these things.
Yeah. I think that, you know, there's no perfect way to evaluate like who's effective and who's not. I think that, you know, people, especially who are like very, very like, you know, identify with the evidence-based stuff, aren't going to like this, but I think that the free market is probably the best tool that we have.
Good point.
If people are willing to pay their own money for something, like we can, people can argue on social media, but the experiment to me is, okay, let's get all these people together that are arguing, put them in a situation where people have to spend their own money. And then let's see, you know, who people want to go to, you know,
that's a great point. Like,
you can only BS somebody so much when the cost is not hidden from them.
Yeah.
I think now in healthcare, the incentives are so perverse that, you know, people put more thought into what television they're going to buy than who they see for PT, because it's like, well, you know, imagine if there was a third party paying for your TV, you'd be like, well, I don't care what TV I'm going to get whatever TV my third party is going to pay for. That's what healthcare has become. So, I know people are going to straw man me. I totally think that people who are indigent should have access to healthcare. But I think that a lot of what's covered by health insurance isn't really, you know, emergency healthcare that insurance should pay for. I think that for some things, you know, a free market or more market-based solution would actually save people a lot of money, because you talked about Kelly. I mean, Kelly doesn't need me to defend him, but for like 5 years, he put out a free video every day about how to exercise with a decent technique and how to do manual therapy on your own. So like at worst, people did that and didn't get any better and had to see a healthcare provider. At best, he saved somebody with a little bit of anterior knee pain from going to a primary care physician, spending a couple $100 of somebody's money, getting an x-ray they didn't need, then going to PT 3 days a week for 6 weeks to do, you know, band exercises, the same stuff that, or better, that he's showing on his platform. So it's like, you know, because he uses the word smash with the ball, everyone's like, oh, he said smash. It's like, you know, this is the healthcare system needs more people like that, that are saying, hey, like, these aren't healthcare medical problems. Like, you can fix this stuff yourself.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, it's mind boggling to me that that's even like, that he's become a controversial figure in the field, because to me, it's like, you know, he's one of the better ambassadors for the field. And again, he doesn't need me to stick up for him. He does a fine job of that himself, but it's like, you know, I really don't get it.
Well, it's early triage too. And this is actually, you know, the last, I guess this was 2 years ago, I was out in Hawaii teaching some tactical courses. One was a TACP group that was out there that had us out. And then I spent 4 days with a battalion that was a cavalry battalion, 25th ID. And what we did was we spent the entire time with their medics. As they asked me, they were like, hey, what should we work on? I was like, give me your medics for 4 days. And all we're going to do, we call it a musculoskeletal first aid. Like, these guys don't get enough, you know, legitimate front end. Here's what you do with problems you're going to see that are musculoskeletal, which is a vast majority of what they're seeing anyway. Yeah. But they can deal with a sucking chest wound. But in garrison, when they're not deployed, that's like almost non-existent. It doesn't happen, right? So, but they're seeing a lot of back pain. They're seeing a lot of knee pain, shoulder impingement. So for 4 days, we took them through all these protocols and basically like cookie cutters. Like, if this happens, do these first. Okay. Mm-hmm. Start here before you send somebody to the PA, because there's one for 600 people. And then for after that, like, keep them out of the hospital system. So keep it in-house, don't put them on profile, and let's see what happens. And the PA was great. They tracked all their injuries over the course of like a 6 month period, and they dropped their profile rates. They dropped their trips to the hospital, and they dropped their injuries, recorded injuries, by like 60% in the course of a 6 month period. Then they deployed. And, you know, a lot of that data, we have it, but it's not like a formal study that has been, you know, whatever, published. But for them, it's like, it makes total sense. How about you take these guys that are, maybe they're not PAs, right? Like you're talking about, that not even the level that you got when you were a PJ. Low level, they come through a medic school, but they want to learn more. They want to learn more about this. They're excited to. And now all of a sudden they have these resources. They start applying it, and they stop people from going through that vicious cycle of sick call. Then you're on profile, then you're getting injection, then you're getting imaging, and all these things that don't actually help them get what they want. Plus the wait time to be seen is 3 to 4 weeks. So in that 3 to 4 weeks, what the hell are they doing? You know, right. So I think that is really where it's at from a treatment of this. It doesn't have to be us. It doesn't have to be a physician. I mean, it literally can be somebody like a coach that has the beginnings of understanding what should be there, what shouldn't be there.
Well, and I love what you just said. And to piggyback on it, what people might not, because you mentioned the military setting, why that's so important is you have these medics in like Afghanistan or Iraq, and they're not just treating combat-related injuries. Right. They are working in garrison. So if you've got somebody, you know, who goes to sick call in Afghanistan with back pain, why they need to know that, at least on a rudimentary level, is if they can't triage, now they might have to risk calling in a helicopter to get that minor back pain patient evacuated. So now you're risking an air crew to pick somebody up in a dangerous place. So that triage is so important. So people might say, oh, well, you know, a medic isn't as perfect as a PT doing musculoskeletal, you know, care in garrison. But the alternative is not a PT because there's only so many PTs. Just like with a platform like Mobility Wad, yeah, in an ideal world, everybody would be able to see, you know, a PT for these minor things or a physician. But that's not the world we live in because, again, there's finite resources. So people might not love things like foam rolling or lacrosse balls, but if that saves somebody from going and getting an injection they wouldn't need, you know, the alternative is not evidence-based care and perfect care. The alternative is probably something that's even worse than them going on a lacrosse ball or doing an exercise on YouTube. So yeah, in a utopian environment, like we could be doing better than these things, but you have to be realistic. And it's like, what's the alternative to that medic providing, you know, care in garrison? The alternative is you're flying in a helicopter and getting that minor back pain patient evacuated to Germany or somewhere else and just wasting resources where they're probably needed on the battlefield. The alternative to a platform like Mobility Wad in real life is, okay, like now they're going to go get an x-ray. They don't need a primary care visit, 10 PT visits when, you know, maybe like they try that thing in the YouTube video and they get better. If they don't, what was lost? Like the upside is the upside of it is so high and the downside is so low.
Yeah.
So again, you have to look at the real world too.
I agree, man. You know, I think we could go, on and on about this for quite some time. And maybe we should just have like a standing like monthly podcast where we can air some grievances. It's just, you know, I think there's a lot of people that feel this way. And I think there's a lot of people that are in the profession that feel probably somewhat threatened with like, oh no, don't share your secrets. You know, this idea of like abundance versus scarcity mentality, we see it in business all the time. I mean, I get it all the time. Like, do you think the people that we have in our mastermind, I'm telling them like, hey, don't go listen to some of these other people. That's like saying like, okay, don't listen to this band because you like this, only listen to this one band. Like, don't ever listen to somebody similar to them. You know, it's just Led Zeppelin. Don't listen to the Rolling Stones. Like, you have to pick one. So it's silly. You know, it's exposure to different things. And I think that people are a bit fearful of change, you know, and when that change occurs, and my goal is to never get there. Like, I drive change right now, and I never want to be in a position where I'm just like, whoa, pump the brakes. Like, you're changing too much, because it's evolution. And if you're not a part of that, then you're slowing down the process of everybody becoming better. So, you know, for you guys, I'm thankful for your time. I'm glad that you're, you know, you made it out of New York before it turned into like a sci-fi movie. And it's so cool to be a part of just from the sidelines, watch what you guys are doing and just see the potential with Resilient, with what you guys have going on, not just from your practice standpoint, but really, you know, what you're talking about, solving bigger problems with the profession and helping them with some of these higher level concepts that, you know, we're not getting in school. It's hard to find organization of that. So, you know, for you guys, if people are interested in learning more about what you're doing, if they want to check out your practice or what you guys are working on from the education standpoint, where can they go and do that?
Yes, our website is resilientperformance.com. And then we have Twitter and Instagram handles are ResilientPPT. And then I have my own Twitter that's GreenFeetPT. So any of those.
You're still on that. So you're still like, you're a Twitter guy, huh?
That's still my favorite, yeah.
I had to get off, man. I was like, I would like have a hard time going to bed. I would be so angry. Well,
what's helpful is I've actually, the accounts that make me angry, I just muted so they don't show up on my feed. Perfect. But I think, you know, if you follow the right people, it is a great place to get information. I do learn a lot there, but I've tried to drown out the voices that, you know, raise my blood pressure before I go to bed.
Yeah. Yeah. And what drives me crazy is like, it's just a medium for people to kind of argue, but like,
yeah,
even if all those, you know, if you and like a couple other people like that are in the exact same room, the tone of the conversation is going to be different. Number one, you know, like you may disagree, but you're not going to be as, you know, as much animosity in how you say it. And, and because you can't touch somebody through Twitter, right? Like there's a completely different scenario. So dude, this has been great. I really appreciate it. Guys, I hope that, you know, you enjoyed this one, and Doug and his business partners are doing an amazing job up in New York City. If you want a good example of like what a performance clinic looks like, out of network cash clinic, check out what they're doing. They're scaling quickly. And once all this is over, you know, you guys, I know you have some big plans already, you know, with moving to kind of standalone spaces, and the growth over the next year will be fun to watch. So Doug, thank you so much for your time, man. We appreciate it. And guys, as always, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Hey, wait a minute. Just to let you guys know, we are closing in on 200 views on iTunes. That's crazy. Most podcasts hardly get to 100 views, let alone 200. And this is such a niche-specific PT business podcast. That's wild. So let's try to rally the troops and get to 200 reviews for this podcast. The first thing you need to do is you got to subscribe to this sucker, whether it's on iTunes or any other platform that you're listening to on, so you know when new episodes are coming out. The next thing, make sure that you leave a review. I'd love to hear what you have to say. I read all of them. It means a lot to me. The next thing, guys, take a screenshot of whatever episode you're listening to and put it in your stories on Instagram and tag me in it. That's at Danny Matei PT. If you do this, I will repost it. So you'll get a bump. I'll get a bump. We'll share this information with a lot more people, because that's the goal, guys. We want to get this information in front of a lot more people. So take a screenshot, share it on Instagram stories, tag me in it, and I will repost it. So here we go. Let's try to get to 200 reviews for the podcast. Thanks for listening.